try and get out a few experiments every single day and learn. And the thing you have to coach your team on is you have to have that collective curiosity about figuring out if this is right or not. And I think too often entrepreneurs and their teams get wedded to a plan over, we don't know if this is going to work yet. And so the urgency is not around executing the plan, which is kind of the training everyone has coming out of whatever background they have. Like, oh, we have a plan and we're going to do this quarterly. And that's usually like people's first jobs. But at a startup, you don't even know if your idea is worthwhile pursuing long run. And the faster you iterate, that natural curiosity is, I think, what gets you to, you know, finding product market fit at some level. And the faster you find it, the more excited, the more inspired everyone gets, because you don't want to go a whole year and people still aren't sure if your company is going to work.
Hello, friends. Welcome to a new episode of the Venture Europe podcast with me, Colleen Fabry. Today's guest is Bharat Vasan, partner and COO at the Production Board, overseeing the consumer technology portfolio. Bharat actively invests in, advises, and serves on the boards of early stage businesses. He's one of Silicon Valley's most battle-tested and proven CEOs and operators, with multiple successful exits and over $500 million money raised. During this episode, we discuss about some trends in consumer tech around AI and food, how they assess founders when investing, and how he struggled with weight loss, and how Ozempic, the miracle drug made by Novo Nordisk, changed his mind, body, and investment strategy. Enjoy.
It's like the, you know, two presidents ago in the US with the T at the end. That's the easiest way to remember. It's not Borat.
Not Borat. Doesn't people call you Borat? Or,
you know, before, you know, Barack Obama got elected, you know, that was the closest thing, you know, and that movie was pretty famous. So the people did go there, but, you know, tried hard to get back to Barat. I have a Starbucks name, too. You probably don't have a Starbucks name, but maybe you do. You know, my Starbucks name is Brad. But they're always like, you know, do you want a cookie? Do you want something? You're just like, listen, we don't need to get into how my name is written. Just, it's Brad is good.
Love it. I actually do have a Starbucks name. It's actually Colin, because my name is Romanian. So it has like a C-A-L-I-N. And on top of the A, you have like this sort of a hat, and it's pronounced Colin. So then when I go to Starbucks, it's like, yeah, Colin, it's perfect.
Colin's great, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much for taking the time. I was actually very excited for you to come on the show because you have this wealth of knowledge. You've been a founder, you've been a CEO, you've been a COO, you've raised 500 plus millions of dollars, and now you are also an investor. So I would love to share a little bit of your wisdom with our audience. Maybe we can just start with the Production Board. At the Production Board, you are overseeing the consumer technology portfolio. So I was wondering, how do you guys assess founders to partner with? What are the criteria?
Great question. I guess first, thanks for having me on. I've had a long love affair with Europe, you know, not just through my early years, but also when I worked at a company called EA, and I worked in video games, and I spent 8 years at EA. And if you know anything about video games, it is a global business. And there are lots and lots of great talent coming out of all parts of Europe, all parts of Japan. And so I got to travel around Europe a lot, but mostly in that pop culture vein, not in the super serious type of stuff, but it was this creative and software field. It was my first exposure to technology and how global technology can be. So give me a better appreciation for that. So I'm excited to talk to folks who are in Europe as well. Coming back to TPB, my name is Bharat. I'm a venture partner at the Production Board. I head up our consumer bets over there. I've spent the last 20 plus years building consumer technology businesses, not just large companies. I've done 3 startups, been lucky enough to have a few exits. One to a European company, Assa Abloy, which is a Finnish-Swedish consortium. TPB, you know, on the consumer side of things, I'm looking a lot, and the areas I'm focused on are around applications of AI, where I'm very interested. And I'm also focused on this broader theme that's resurgent around weight loss, again, created by a European company, Novo Nordisk, around GLP-1 drugs. So those are 2 areas I'm interested in. In terms of founders, you know, there's lots of things I look for. I think intelligence, knowledge of the space that you're going into. And I think, you know, we index on like 3 things, grit, bit bias to action and the ability to tell a story. Because I think those three things are key to inspiring people to join your startup, to invest in your startup, particularly the storytelling part of it. I think the bias to action is very much, I think, ingrained in most entrepreneurs, which is let's get something done now and let's try stuff out on the market and figure out if it works, whether it's the story or the product or something to customers or go to market. You want to figure that out as fast as possible. But the last thing I think is actually really hard to coach, and that is grit. And I would say when I was an entrepreneur and I went from a big company to starting my first company, you know, many things had prepared me for lots of that experience in life. So, you know, I was prepared for, oh, I'm going to do a lean startup and it's just going to be me. But nothing had really prepared me for how volatile the experience is. The highs are really high. The lows are really low. It's a very lonely existence. You don't even know why you're doing it some days. And so it really is one of those faith-based initiatives where you really have to believe it more than the world is willing to believe it for very long periods of time with very many people, including your parents, your friends, everyone going, yeah, I don't know if it's a great idea. Just, you know, it seems a little goofy. It seems a little out there. And, you know, it's been 2.5, 3 years. And you just have to keep going. And you get these big step-like breaks. But it's very, very hard on, I think, entrepreneurs when you're going through that phase, because it doesn't feel like you'll make it often. But I'm living proof, and so are many other people, that, you know, you do get there, but it's not easy.
How do you assess the bias to action? So I would assume that the storytelling aspect, you can very quickly tell if they have a clarity of thinking, if they thought about the narrative that they're then using it to convince investors and then team members. But then how do you assess bias to action and grit in the early conversations with a founder?
Well, I'll take bias to action first. Because I focus on technology investing, I'm always looking to figure out what have you shipped? And, you know, if you talk to anyone who's worked with me at a company, I'm looking for the velocity at which you put out stuff, not the velocity at which you think about stuff, not the velocity at which you put slide decks together, not the velocity at which you pitch, but like how good are you at assembling a team and getting them to start to ship whatever, like, you know, that minimum desirable product is iteratively and getting it out. You know, in my background, I've done a lot of physical products as well. So, you know, not just software, but software combined with hardware. And people who built hardware, like, you will know it takes time. There's no easy way to ship it, you know, in 2 months, 3 months, or 6 months. You've got, it's a whole build cycle. It's a little bit more waterfall than it is agile. And, you know, it could take a year to 4 years to ship your product. And that's true in climate tech. It's true in food, some of the spaces where Europe is known to be big in. But the faster you can get it out, the faster you get feedback. So I look for, do people have that track record in their past? Because some people just have that level of urgency and get it. Otherwise, it's easy to just have it bleed on. And then I look at the recent past, like, you know, in their first things that they're doing in their startup, did they figure out how to check with customers first? Did they have a concept of, you know, how customer feedback iterates into the product so you can adjust that with the very, very, very limited resources you have? And so those two things around, like, what have you shipped in the past? How quickly did you do it? And just talking through, hey, what are you doing day to day? How are you spending your time? How quickly does that feedback from the market bleed into the product? How quickly do you get that back out again? And the faster that flywheel is, I think easier things become.
When you look at velocity, do you have like a best practice? So let's say this is a software product, this is not hardware. Let's say this is a B2C, this is more consumer. Do you have a benchmark? Okay, if you got the feedback from the customer in 2 weeks or a week or a day, like I just talked with James Currier from NFX, and it was like, yeah, we were doing like two experiments, like before lunch and then two after lunch. You know, I'm like, oh, wow. And some of the founders in Europe from scale-ups, they listened to that episode. And they called me and was like, thank God that you put that episode out, because I tried to convince my team to do more experiments to get the feedback, but they are scared. So do you have like a benchmark of velocity? And if you see that it's above that, then you try to probe why it's so long. And if it's under that, or I'm like, okay, this is, I think you're on track and you're shipping fast enough and you give yourself enough time to build something that matters and is valuable.
Look, James is one of the best and a good friend, so I can't add too much to what he said, except that velocity is important. I don't know that there's one heuristic. realistic. I think the balance is always at the team level when you're building teams. The anxiety is always, oh, what will people think? If we put out a crappy product, you know, nobody will come back. And what I will tell entrepreneurs is in the early days, I don't know that too many people care, unless it's health and safety and you're doing drugs or food or something with certifications. I think those things, you know, you have a longer build cycle. But if you're building software, I think James is exactly right. You know, try and get out a few experiments every single day and learn. And the thing you have to coach your team on is you have to have that collective curiosity about figuring out if this is right or not. And I think too often entrepreneurs and their teams get wedded to a plan over, we don't know if this is going to work yet. And so the urgency is not around executing the plan, which is kind of the training everyone has coming out of whatever background they have. Like, oh, we have a plan and we're going to do this quarterly. And that's usually like people's first jobs. But at a startup, you don't even know if your idea is worthwhile pursuing long run. And the faster you iterate, that natural curiosity is, I think, what gets you to, you know, finding product market fit at some level. And the faster you find it, the more excited, the more inspired everyone gets, because you don't want to go a whole year and people still aren't sure if your company is going to work, but everyone's really attached to this plan. Since you brought that up, that's a really important screening point for team members you bring on. Do you guys all share curiosity around discovering a common purpose? You know, whether it is curiosity around a common purpose. So if you've said like, look, I'm going to focus on carbon sequestration and I've got this very specific method of building concrete in a new way, do you have the curiosity to quickly iterate to see, is that true? And if it's not true, what else can we do with it? We all know we want to build a startup, but like, how fast can we iterate through the details of it? And it's not the big picture. I think the big picture always attracts people. A lot of what makes a startup successful is the details. It's the fine little nuances of like, oh, this thing for that customer with this pricing and that go to market. And this is, you know, in James's case, like with network effects, this is what gets the flywheel going is a really important part of it. And most software businesses, especially in the consumer side, don't have a real big moat. You know, getting that flywheel going of people coming in, enjoying the product, coming back, like whatever that thing is, especially marketplaces, that's particularly important. And that takes a long time to build. So the sooner people get started, the better it is.
Do you remember a recent meeting that you had with a founder that really impressed you? What was it like?
The most recent meeting I had with a founder that really impressed me, I think is a good example of someone. So as you know, I've been a deep interest in this GLP-1 space. So I met a founder who's kind of in the obesity management space. And the obesity management space has been around for a long, long, long time, right? Because it's a function of like, you know, what you eat and how much stress is in your life and how much you exercise and like what kind of things you eat in your cultural context. There's a lot of different variables that go in. So people have been trying to solve it for a long time.
Do you want to try to tell us what's the GLP-1?
Yeah, let me start with a little background there. So GLP-1s are a new class of drugs that have, you know, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, I think, are the two largest makers of this drug. But it's a new class of drugs that help promote like a sensation of satiety, you know, of feeling full. They make less hungry, so you eat less. It slows down your digestion. And as a function of the drug, you also don't have the same cravings you do for food all the time. So it's a product that is allowing, at this point, it's 10% of all scripts written in the United States, which is a huge amount. You know, people in Europe can't relate to how heavy on pharma the U.S. goes, but 10% is a lot for what goes out of our pharmacies. There are probably 15 million Americans on it, going to 100 million. The entire population is only 340 million. So this has been around for the last 2 or 3 years, but has really been taking off over, I would say, the last 18 months. And it's because obesity is a huge problem in the US. And so finally, you have a drug that is a solution to, hey, I'm craving food, I want to eat. And the US is full of delicious foods. I think most countries are. And the food system is essentially rigged against consumers, and it's designed for people to eat more. And as a result, we eat a lot of processed foods. And in the U.S., we have a huge problem with obesity. Most of the population at this point, the adult population, having issues with obesity, which then results in cardiac disease, other comorbidities that affect people's lives. And so GLP-1 drugs have become this lifesaver. You hear large retailers like Walmart talking about the fact that it's causing a reduction in food consumption because people are literally just eating less. And they're eating different types of food. So it's changing patterns in food consumption as well. But coming back to your question, entrepreneur I met, MD, used his own clinic to experiment with new obesity protocols. So maybe these GLP-1 drugs don't work for everyone, but helping figure out how at a clinic you provide people with the coaching, how you get insurance to cover it. He'd used something he was already doing to build a product and iterate on that. And now he's coming out for venture capital, but he's already spent a long time thinking about it, refining it before he even comes out. And those are the kinds of founders I like. Because because they were interested in this space before the GLP-1 kind of takeoff. So they're not people who came into the market because they saw something exciting. But it's certainly helpful that he's already thought through a lot of these steps as this comes. So he's thinking about being in the space for 10, 15, 20 years, as opposed to, hey, I had an idea yesterday and I'm just starting out.
Got it. And on the other side, what are some red flags that maybe you get triggered in early conversation with founders?
You know, most venture investors get so many pitches from so many different people. And eventually, you know, you go through like, look, they've checked off all of our criteria. They're qualified. They're smart. The market is a big market. Like, and so you go through your checklist of stuff when you're doing diligence. I think the thing I try and imagine and the thing that's not written on the pitch decks that I'm trying to suss out and I was doing as an entrepreneur is what is it going to be? Because the entrepreneur is always pitching, you know, that it always feels like that you're trying to sell someone on something, and it's what you've been doing with employees and investors and business partners. You're always selling something. And with that dynamic, it's always hard to figure out what is a working relationship with this person going to be like. Because once you have an investor, that's a long-term relationship. And I think it's helpful for both entrepreneurs. You know, I have that lens as much as I have an investor. I've been an investor for 4 years, but I've been an entrepreneur for much longer. What is that working relationship going to look like? And so the things I look for in the meeting is, you know, when people ask critical questions or they're pushing you, what does that actual interaction feel like? Do they feel threatened? Do they go in sell mode? Do they acknowledge these are the parts we know that we don't know? Because it's also reflective of what your board meetings might look like. It's reflective of what conversations you're going to have when, oh my God, we're running out of money. Will you put in a little bit more to bridge us? Or things are going really, really well. Should we raise another round? Should we sell the company? Do I have to do a layoff? These are hard questions, right? And when you're talking about a startup that's, you know, five people, or 20 people, it feels existential in that moment. And as an entrepreneur, you want to feel like your investors provide you with good critical feedback, knowing that they have a finite amount of time. And as an investor, you want to feel like you can provide candid feedback without the entrepreneur going, hey, you might not like to hear it, but that's different from having an unproductive relationship. And I think too few entrepreneurs and too few investors vet for that relationship up front. I think it's just the nature of the business. But one thing for me, I look for is just, you know, what is this going to look like past the dating phase, the honeymoon phase, when we have to build a real business and make this a truly successful company?
Do you have some questions that you try to ask or break the pattern of the salesy mode?
No, I don't think there's any one way in asking it. It's the interaction itself. I know that's a hard thing to describe, but imagine you're meeting with, you know, a friend and they're really excited about something, you know, and you think it's a dumb idea. And imagine how that conversations go. What's the kindest possible way in which you can have that discussion? Maybe they change your mind. Maybe you change their mind. But, you know, I try and have that lens of like, what's the best way to get through to ask the question without coming across as what I would call it, lack of a better word, a typical VC, which is like, that's terrible. It's too small a market. Or, you know, someone tried that 6 years ago in a different time, in a different space, in a different country. And I saw this other pitch and yours is not going to work because theirs won't either. You know, I think there are investors that are good and bad at providing that feedback. But I try and imagine, yeah, this is a colleague, this is a friend. They're going to go through difficult times. What's the best way to get through to them in a way that they'll be receptive to the question, and then we can get into the real discussion in a non-threatening way where they feel like whatever they get out of this conversation is going to be valuable, whether it results in funding or not.
And consumers can be very volatile. I was wondering, how do you guys look at trends? Try to separate the fads, consumers just going out and trying some stuff and then letting it go, with structural trends that you know are going to play out in the future and it's worth investing?
That's a great question. I put it in two buckets. You know, I think Mark Andreessen said this, or someone said this recently. There's two things I look at. One thing is just what are long-term durable needs, right? People will always care about their weight. People will always care about money management. There are certain things that people just care about over the long run. Climate people, you know, a new generation of people, maybe not an older generation of people, feels like a durable thing that people will care about. What people put in their food and into their bodies, you know, is something people care about. And that's where you see big new consumer companies built. And so I look at durable needs as one category. The other thing I look at, particularly for software companies, is what is taking off. And I think actually AI fits in that other category as well. As you reimagine consumer experiences in the future, this technology is going to be around, and everything from your insurance management to your travel booking is going to change. Things you already use are going to change. And so the question is just, do you have the imagination around how it can change and how seamless it can be? Because honestly, 10 years ago, those experiences were a lot worse. And people forget that when it comes to software and, you know, cloud-based experiences. Or 20 years ago, Google didn't exist and it was a different experience around search. And so 15, 20 years from now, it'll be a different experience around search, looking up things, booking, etc. The other thing I look at is what what's taking off right now? What are people excited about? What are they interested in? What are the little nuances? And it's a little like pop culture divining it, like, you know, where is music headed? Where is art headed? Where is culture headed? Because that's a new cohort, a new generation of people with new concerns, right? And their lives are happening in real time. And that's where you can find, like, you know, the Snapchats of the world, where that behavior would not be common. And people are like, what do you mean you send disappearing messages? What's the point of that? And a whole other generation just wouldn't get the point of that. And the Snapchat generation probably wouldn't get, like, the TikTok thing, which is like, you know, well, it's like YouTube, but, like, it goes really fast. And so I do think, like, you know, large consumer companies can be built around these very durable, changing micro interactions where the zeitgeist is out. And so I look for that type of thing. I tend to stay away from things in the middle where it's hard to build conviction. But if there's a small group of people who are extremely passionate about some niche and they really, really love it, and, you know, they're willing to go evangelize and convince a whole bunch of people, and they're doing it now, I feel like that's a good place to start a flywheel type of business, you know, and find product market fit. And if there's some long-term, really big problem that needs to be solved, I think that's another place to build a big company over time.
Do you have some examples at the application AI layer where you think that there are some industries that can get disrupted, or if you think that actually we're thinking the wrong way, we're thinking the old way, whereas like new industries will get created with AI and in the consumer space?
Gosh, I don't know if we have time to go through all of that for consumer, but just, you know, imagine all of the stuff that takes you many, many, many steps today. Your travel bookings, you know, I don't know how European insurance works, but if you're a homeowner, you got to file an insurance claim because you had a roof leak. You're trying to manage your finances, figure out, you know, what it is for retirement, but, you know, maybe you want to talk to a person, but today you go on the internet and you're trying to use tools. They're pretty good, but there's still work to be done and you have to get familiar with the tool. I think there's three areas which I think on the consumer AI side that I'm excited. I'll bucket them into three things. I would say there's the instant need. And what I mean by that is I want to look up something really quick. What's the answer to X, right? And I want it that fast. And I don't want to go through 15 blue links. I want just the answer to get that. And I think so there's that instant need of something. Mobile phones solve that to some degree, but I think it's going to get even faster and better with AI. The second thing is instant productivity. Then what I'd call is, like, you know, medium and long-term productivity, which would be like, I need to book a trip for my family and we're going to go someplace else. So give me some options. Or I want to go see Taylor Swift or some band. You know, anyone who's been through like Ticketmaster or any of those sites is like, which seat over here and what's the view going to be? Like, it's a whole, and like, what price is it going to be at? And should I book it now? And I have 5 seconds left to book it. That experience sucks. And the question is, you know, is there going to be something better that helps you do these more complex tasks? That's where companies like, you know, there's a company called Rabbit in the US, which is this little red device that showed up at CES. And the promise is you'll have all these agents that can, you know, that are voice controlled and go off and do stuff on your behalf. But I'm really excited about things that make that long term, or home construction. There's so many needs in people's life that take more planning. And the question is, can you have your own kind of mini chief engineer, you know, chief travel planner, like doing stuff for you on your behalf, giving you options so you can make quick decisions. And the last thing that I'm really, really excited about, and I think this is the emotional part about human beings and consumer, is I'm interested in this concept around extended memory. And what I mean by extended memory is one of the things, you know, you look at is like, oh, you know, I love going back, you know, to India to see my mom and my parents. And you're trying to recall these things. And the closest thing we have, if you look at like, you know, 10 years ago, your ability to have as many pictures to now, you're able to have all these things, but now you have a lot of different pictures. And so I think the question is, you know, are there renditions? And coming out of CES, that's maybe the thing that I'm most excited about. And I don't know exactly how it's going to shake out, but this notion that you'd be able to recollect what was said in this meeting, right? What were the highlights of this meeting? Or I went to that, what did I commit to in a business partnership meeting? I had an employee and I talked to them and it was a difficult conversation. Like, you know, did I handle it the right way? Like, you know, like little coaching in the moment type of thing. Things that help us be better in the moment is stuff that doesn't exist primarily because there's no memory of them. It's all sitting in your head, each person's head and their own perception of it. So I'm interested in things that give human beings memory, longitudinal memory over time, so they can look back and say, you know what, 10 years ago, I was a sucky manager. Here are the ways in which I've improved, but God, I can't believe I said that. Like, I would fail that test. I would probably not hire me today. And the question is, can you relive your favorite moments? Can you look at things that you could have done better? Can you accelerate accelerate that process. And I do think that part is emotional, and it is different from being immersed in passive video streaming type of stuff. But like, you know, that fun moment you have with your wife on your honeymoon, like whatever that thing is, that is really, really cool. I think that is really, really emotional. The only way to collect it right now is to pull out a phone and kind of do it. But I think new devices are coming up that will help you sort of relive that. And then you can relive that on a Vision Pro. I've tried it. It's awesome. I recommend it. You know, but you get that immersive experience of going back to a moment in time that was your happy place. And I think that can be a really positive thing for a lot of humans at a time of a lot of change and a lot of stress.
Do you know what this reminds me of? I don't know if you saw this Black Mirror episode, the entire history of you.
Yeah.
And there is this lawyer that actually has this lens, and it's an external memory. So you can actually go and scroll through your memory. So it's a very interesting episode. I highly recommend if you haven't watched it, because it has like all these philosophical questions. Like, would you actually choose to implement an external memory and always go back? Because, you know, memories are not accurate, and some bad memories, we can decide to make them a little bit more pretty, but we can pretty much decide on the narrative with our memories. And it was this beautiful scene where everyone is at the table and this one person decided to have it off. And it was like this discussion, oh my God, you don't have it? You don't have the external memory? So it's almost like maybe someone today not having, I don't know, Twitter or Facebook or Snapchat, or not being like on the internet. Like, what do you mean you're not on the internet? So it's very funny to also see and to think about the implications, because on one hand, I completely agree with you. You can relive all those beautiful moments, or you can even like project what something might look like. You know, you can be on a beach somewhere just for 30 minutes because you know that you have this trip coming up. So it definitely can augment your happiness. I would like to maybe circle back on the Ozempic and GLP-1 drugs. I know that you wrote an op-ed titled How Ozempic Changed My Mind, Body, and Investment Strategy. And also there, you're very vulnerable talking about how you actually struggle to lose weight for a number of years and how this is almost like a miracle drug. From your own personal experience, like, how do you think this industry is going to evolve? And then the second part of it, how do you think then pharma is going to eat from big food industry and eat at this $500 billion snack aisle?
So let's see. Yes, I did write an op-ed. The basic gist of it, so your viewers don't have to read it, is, you know, I lost 40 pounds in Ozempic and what is that, 13 or 14 kilograms, something like that. And I've struggled with weight because startups are stressful. And, you know, someone pointed out, because I posted the chart of the last, you know, I've been in connected devices and wearables. So I've been standing on a WeThings, you know, connected scale now for 15 or 20 years. Not intentionally, it's just, you know, I stand on it and now it has this longitudinal data. And someone pointed out to me, they texted me like, hey, this looks like the peak of every startup you've done. You can see like the stress building, and like you can see like, you know, when you've had an exit, or, you know, then you have the downtime and you have time to focus on your health. And I think the reason people struggle is because, you know, there's cultural context, there's diet, and there's stress in your lives. And, you know, human beings have a finite amount of willpower. Every morning you wake up and there's so much willpower you have, and you can give it to your, you know, your family, your friends, your diet, your exercise, your work especially. And it's fully depleted at some point in time. And managing your weight and managing your health requires a certain amount of willpower. And there's people who are naturally motivated or able to do that. You know, I'm okay at it, but not great. Mine yo-yos over time. And if you look at the last 15, 20 years, you'll see like, you know, these big peaks and valleys. And they usually correspond with stressful times, usually at work. I think a lot of founders can relate to that. I've lost weight before, so you kind of know what the path is. You know, you get told the same things like, listen, I'm going to, you know, you're going to have to eat right, and you're going to have to exercise, and you're going to have to stress less. And, you know, I wish life was as easy as being able to do all those things at the same time, every single day consistently. But what I learned from building my first startup, which is in the digital health space and the fitness tracking wearable space, it's called Basis. And, you know, we had a fitness tracker you'd wear, it was one of the first fitness trackers with the heart rate sensor out there. What I learned was it's very hard for human beings, even when you have data, even when you have instant feedback, to maintain that intensity consistently day in and day out. I think that's just one of those things human beings tend not to do consistently over time. Your friends are going out, you want to go out with them, or, you know, you had a stressful day, you revert to your favorite food. Like, you have all these triggers around it. And I've never been a big, you know, a pharma person. And like most consumers, I'm like, I don't know. Sure, the doctor said that, but how badly do I really need it? Yes, I've been one of those type of people. And I decided to take Ozempic, not because my doctor prescribed it, but, you know, and this is going to sound horrible, I'm going to tell the audience this for the first time. I was watching a lot of people on TikTok and other sites talking about their experience. Because I, you know, what I do as consumer, I couldn't figure out why people would want to talk about medicine that they were taking. And I couldn't figure out why no one else cared. It seemed like, you know, they had this little bubble of people that love talking about it, a little subculture. And the rest of people are like, I don't know what this is about. And it's really not content for me. But it's very unusual. Like, people don't talk about statins or heart meds or like any of the other stuff they're on. So this seemed like an unusual behavior. And I tried it. And what was amazing about it is, you know, the way that these GLP-1 drugs is they work with your GLP-1 receptor and essentially turn off these feelings of like hunger, and they promote feelings of being full. They slow your digestive tract so you can eat as much. So, you know, what I found was over time, because it takes like, I think, maybe a month for the thing to start actually kicking in. It's like a graduated process of different doses. It's like a little EpiPen that you poke yourself with. There's edible forms coming out as well. For the first month, you don't start losing weight because it's impossible to start losing kilograms a day. Like the human body just doesn't function that way. Your metabolism has to adjust. So it took me 4 months, 5 months to lose the 13 kilograms, an amount I could never have imagined. I would have to basically just full-time be doing that for the full-time person and doing nothing else. Like I've just never been able to do that. But the thing that you notice that the more, like literally, I think within a few days, is you just don't have the cravings for food. Like you have the stress and you have everything the same in your life, but you just don't have the same craving for food. And it takes away this huge mental load around thinking about what you're going to have for dinner or what you're going to order on DoorDash or Grubhub or Uber Eats or whatever it is. And if you live in a city, everything is available to you all the time. If you go through a supermarket, everything is available to you all the time. And, you know, food and anxiety and stress have this strong connection. And I think the improved access to food instantly and cheap food and delicious tasting food has, like, you know, been something that the food system is really optimized for over nutrition. But the thing I noticed within, like, you know, a few days was I just didn't feel like eating it. So I had this, I call it a great product because it preserves this illusion of free will. So I could eat whatever I want to, but I just don't feel like it. And I think that's very different experience from the weight loss experience of all these years, where the experience has been, you have to do this, you should do this, you should do that, and you should not do that. And if you don't do it, you deserve to be overweight. Like whatever the narrative is, I think there's so much wrapped up in that societal and actual kind of, you know, food construct that I think it's hard for people to manage. And this is the first time that, you know, something, a product, whether it's pharma or not, made it possible to not have that discussion. My experience was, you know, I started trying the product. Within a few days, I didn't feel like eating that much. So basically, I ended up eating half as much I was eating before. So, you know, Americans have big portions. Europeans are always surprised when they come here and, like, you know, there's two croissants instead of one croissant or whatever the heuristic is. You know, the portions are extra large, Olive Garden size. And I just couldn't finish the stuff anymore. So I was eating half as much. And off the other half that I was eating, half of that was basically food that I like. And the other half was stuff that you have to have. So one thing about GLP-1 drugs is if you're going to keep losing weight, you need to get all of your nutrients in. You know, for example, taking enough protein. Otherwise, your body's going to start consuming muscle instead. And muscle is very, very hard to build back. And so you need a certain amount of protein intake every day. But the food system is not set up to deliver 30 grams plus of protein, you know, in food every day. So my food habits had to change on that remaining 25%. And that's a great heuristic for what I think is going to happen in this big, you know, big pharma versus big food type of battle. I don't think it was set up that way. I'm making it controversial. But the reason you hear Walmart talk about it in the US is because people are going to be eating half as much. That means half as much cereal, half as many snack bars, half as much, you know, of your favorite food. It's going to happen at fast food because your digestive tract slows. So if you're eating greasy food, the grease welts to the top and instantly your body's systems kick in and be like, you know what? I can't finish that burger. I can't finish this, you know, whatever other, you know, chips thing that I used to love. I can only eat two or three of them. And that consumption reduction is going to happen across the board. And when I say big food, it's not just processed foods. It's also restaurants. It's all the places people shop. And because you need nutritional density in what you are eating right now, I think that's going to change the composition of foods that are actually on the aisle. And so my big prediction is, you know, I think this product has already proven to be a big product. You can see that in the stock prices of Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly, the adoption rates. And I know it hasn't made it to Europe yet, I don't think. Most Americans are still becoming aware of it. So it seems like it's overhyped, but it's like looking at Facebook 20 years ago and being like, well, it's overhyped. And then you're here 20 years later and it's still up and the stock is up 5x and it's just like, how, you know, and then about 10 years from now it might be something new. And so I think this is going to continue for a long time. There are large countries like India, large places in the Middle East that deal with this obesity problem because of the cultural context. And so I do think this is a miracle drug. I think it will save many, many lives. And then the process of doing so, I think it will re-engineer food systems because people who are either looking for an alternative to Ozempic are going to want to find GLP-1 boosting foods. People who are on Ozempic are going to be consuming less, but they're going to want higher protein content. And then people who are coming off of it, you know, are going to be conditioned to a different type of diet. And that is going to bleed all the way through the ecosystem. How can it not? And so it's a great time for brands to be built, a great time for people to be educated on the process of it. It's a great time, you know, insurance doesn't cover it in many cases in the US. So how do they get cheaper, affordable, and in the hands of more people with a doctor's prescription that makes sense? I think that is yet to play out. I think it's probably a 15-20 year cycle. And I think because there's this fundamental contradiction between people are not eating as much anymore, then big food has to change its form factors. They might, you know, increase the pricing or whatever it is, but something has to change about how the food aisles, particularly in America. I haven't been through, you know, European food aisles. I assume they're healthier, but in the US, when I came to America, like, man, I loved walking down the food aisles because we have 500 different types of cereal, and that's just one aisle. And then the next aisle is like, you know, pizzas, and there's like 100 different types. That is amazing. In your 20s, that's great. In your 30s and 40s, you know, not so great. And so, you know, GLP-1 drugs, I've heard so many people after I wrote my piece talk about their journey. I still think it feels a little like plastic surgery or Botox, where people don't feel totally comfortable about talking about it. But I wanted to talk about it because I do think there are going to be a lot of people in this category. It's an interesting opportunity for both investors, but also entrepreneurs to build big businesses.
Absolutely. And also it kind of seems that there is a awareness that rises in the collective consciousness about what to eat and to eat more healthy. So it's interesting to see these two trends pairing each other. What do you think are some products that are very well placed to win?
I think the businesses in the near term that are doing the best are the lead generation businesses like the Ro, the Hims & Hers, the Weight Watchers, you know, but they're just funneling people into these drugs, kind of like they funneled people into ED or minoxidil. And I think that'll run its course over time. I think there are big opportunities if you're on the investing side. I mean, you can always invest in the stocks. I don't know how, you know, they're pretty well priced now, but it's a very large market. But if you just look at Novo and Eli stock, you know, it has rocketed through the roof. And that's with us talking about the fact that most people aren't aware of this. And so what's going to happen when it's like statins in the US, where like half of all adults or more are on statins, which are like blood thinners, and Ozempic might just be people might be on it to, you know, they might be off it. This might be something that they are on and off, you know, for their whole life. It might be like Advil at some point. But I think there's huge opportunities in food. You know, we have a company called Supergut, for example, that builds bars and shakes. And basically the product, you know, is for gut health. And it helps people lower their A1C levels, their blood sugar levels. And GLP-1 drugs, because the product provides protein, it's like a natural Ozempic almost. And so for people who aren't ready to take that, you know, plunge into pharma, they're interested in it. But I also think people who are on Ozempic are like, hey, you know, I'm not going to do a Clif bar or like, you know, like many of the other bars that are out there. This is the thing that speaks to me. It's kind of designed perfectly for me. And over the last, like I would say, you know, 12 months or so, that company's sales have really skyrocketed. You know, Mark Washington, who's the founder of the business, is, you know, talking about it. But after a good example for entrepreneurs around grit and persistence, but after 2.5 years of like having a great product, but not figuring out exactly, you know, who it works really well for, Supergut seems to have found something. And when they go and talk to retailers and buyers, they're like, you know, they are concerned. They're concerned about fewer snack bars are being sold and, you know, fewer shakes are being sold. And I think you're going to see that across cereals, you know, just like you saw with keto, there were keto compatible cereals. And you saw that with dairy, which is like, look, we have non-dairy alternatives that you can put in your coffee. I think you're going to see this wave of like, you know, GLP-1 compatible foods that work for a very, very large audience. And I think it'll become a durable need. It'll be high protein. It'll have many of the vitamins and minerals you need. And after you get off of Ozempic, the stuff is expensive. People are still going to want some foods that promote that feeling of satiety, because you're right, they're more meaningful, they're more mindful about what they eat. And so foods that I think cater to that, promote that, I think have a huge opportunity in what I think is going to be, you know, $100, $200, $300 billion category.
Let's change gears a little bit and let's get personal. You're an experienced investor, operator in consumer tech, 15 years, being a founder, CEO, COO, board roles. You've exited two businesses. You've raised $500 million. What do you attribute your success to?
It's a good question. I think first and foremost, probably a fair amount of luck, because I think any entrepreneur that pretends that, you know, you can get to exits or big outcomes or whatever it is, or join the company at the right time, probably fooling themselves, and, you know, there's not a good amount of luck. But I do think there's ways you can maximize that opportunity. And I do think two things help. One thing is preparing, just like sports, preparing for the opportunity before it arrives. So you don't get good at storytelling, for example, the day you have to tell the story. You have to run that play 100 times in your head with other people long before you get there. And, you know, as someone who was an immigrant to the US, I had to fit into a completely different society. I came from India. I actually learned English from watching American TV shows, old shows like Knight Rider with David Hasselhoff. Like, this is how I actually learned English. And to arrive in like the promised land was like a really big deal for me. But, you know, I had to figure out how to navigate here. And so I think there was a little bit of the immigrant, like, I've got to figure this out, and I've got to figure out how to communicate, and, you know, what to communicate, and what are my thoughts relative to what's being told to me. And so I think having that willingness to practice things before you get to the big moment, I think always helps a great deal as an entrepreneur. And then the other thing that I don't think anyone can train for this, just know that everyone has a different experience. And talked about grit a little bit, but I don't think, you know, like, I thought, like, I'd been through hard times, you know, coming out of India and college and blah, blah, blah. But it turns out, like, it wasn't as hard as being an entrepreneur. And so, you know, making it personal for entrepreneurs, I think there were many lonely nights. There are many days when everyone's gone home, you're sitting there at 1 a.m. doing some PowerPoint deck or, you know, Google Slides deck, and you're wondering what you're even doing there and why everyone else isn't in the office. Like, you have all these emotional thoughts that I don't think I was really prepared for. You know, as much as I thought that I'd seen a lot, and this was like already in my, like, in a mid-20s, I think the highs are really high, the lows are really low. You know, you'd work on a product with your co-founders for like weeks or months, and just before you launch it, like, TechCrunch will post the exact same product, but with all of your features, when everything else. And then you're watching this product, and like within 3 weeks, like, nobody wants to use it. And you're just like, oh my God, we've just wasted all this time. So, like, these are normal experiences. So, you know, I think having grit, having people around you that care about the same things, having a good network of friends, having a vision around what kind of culture you want to be surrounded by, like, I'm big on that when you're building a company. You might not know the outcome, but you can control and maximize a lot of your personal choices around who you surround yourself with and how you're going to do that. It might not be a first start that succeeds, it might be your second or your third. But at each step, you want to get just a little bit better. And that's what I meant by that practicing thing, and think about it as a journey. I don't think I had that perspective when I started, which is why it was very hard. I was more of the, this is my plan, I'm going to be successful, and so why is life not working out this way? And my parents weren't entrepreneurs, so they couldn't give me any advice. And, you know, my friends weren't great at giving advice because they were doing their own thing. And I think there's a much better support systems now, but just this recognition of luck plays a role, but you're going to have to do a lot of practice that's going to go nowhere. You're going to get 90% no's. That doesn't mean you won't succeed, but all of that isn't wasted. It's just making you better. It compounds over time. The no's aren't the end of it. Like, you did learn something in preparing to get that no that taught you something about yourself. And hopefully it causes you to shift stuff. I've shifted who I am as a leader over time. I've shifted, you know, who I've surrounded myself with over time. I've expanded my horizon, so I have more people that can tell me the things I need to hear. Because I think in the entrepreneur role, or, like, you know, in the CEO role, but you hear maybe 10% of the feedback. Like, venture investors are like, oh, it's not right for us. And there's usually something they're not telling you. Like, there's something important that you needed to hear, but either you failed to elicit that feedback through them or through other means that would have helped you a great deal. And so you get more skilled around having that conversation over time. And I think those things have helped my success over time. And today when I advise CEOs and board members, like, you know, these are grown people with successful businesses. And so getting through to them becomes the art, right? Like, what is the way in which they can become receptive to the feedback is almost as important as the feedback itself.
You mentioned quite a lot about the highs and the lows, and the highs are very high and the lows are very low. What are some tools, or what should entrepreneurs do? The entrepreneurs listening, also, I guess, like, a lot of them are first-time entrepreneurs here in Europe. They're first-time entrepreneurs, and they go through, but they don't know necessarily how to normalize the ups and downs. What would be your tips for that?
Well, first of all, there are people who are just naturally great at it. There are people who are just even keeled through their whole life. I wish I was like that. I'm not. And nothing had really prepared me for this. I know meditation helps a lot of people. I have not been a great meditator. My wife will tell you that. And so I've completely failed at that. So having failed that, I think it helps to have someone to talk to. You know, I'm a big fan of therapy, not because something is wrong, but I think it's helpful to understand startups are an incredibly volatile experience. So it's not about fixing that something that's wrong. It's about having, at least in my case, finding a place in yourself that you know that you're going to be okay. Like you, the person, is going to be okay, different from your startup. And those two things are not the same. And I think the single biggest thing that probably could have helped me on my first few startups is just that I'm not the same as my startup. You know, because I think the way I was generating energy to move the startup forward was like these two things are the same. And so if my startup fails, like, you know, this is the end of me and everything is going to end. I think it's a useful tool to motivate yourself, but I don't think it's healthy. And I think going to a therapist for the first time and talking through those issues really helped me separate myself. It's not easy. And so I know it's not right for everyone, but you know, it's probably the number one thing that helped me understand that I can create energy and excite people and get people into a startup and build a successful business without, like, you know, the highs and lows if customer didn't work out or funding fell through or like whatever the thing is, feel like it's the end of the world. Because the energy you put out is also the energy you get back. And so I think if you're an emotional person and it affects you, you're going to amplify that, send it back to your team, and it just creates this negative feedback loop that's not helpful. And the same thing works in reverse. You can create a positive feedback loop. So I think that probably helped me the most.
Also, you see like all this peer support networks coming up, or you have Young President Organization. They have like 30,000 members across the world. They make, what, 150 million euros annual recurring revenue. You have Chief. So you have also, I think, like new generation of togetherness, I think it's called, that maybe 776 invested. But that focus maybe a little bit on what you said, maybe both kind of business advice from peers, but more like therapy, where you kind of can go there and be yourself and share the challenges and get some feedback.
I think that's a great platform. I think the hardest thing for entrepreneurs is, you know, signaling risk. Who am I going to tell about, you know, how badly things are going? Things are going great. Like, everyone's like, things are going great. Like, that's not hard. But when things are not working out as well, or you need to make personnel changes, or, you know, these very big decisions, it helps to have forums. It's very hard to go to your board to talk about that. And this is why I think about, like, who do I want on my board? Who do I want on my cap table if I'm starting a company? And the same thing on the investor side. Who can I have candid conversations with? But I think those support networks are incredibly valuable to people. And usually out of those, you'll get one or two lifelong people, because this isn't like something that's going to disappear. You're going to be 60 years old and still calling up your friend about some home construction thing. But it's more about finding your people. Maybe that's a better way of putting it, that care about similar things, but have a different perspective. And they're like not the voice you want to hear, but the voice you need to hear.
I like that. Finding your people. The last question, if Bharat from 20 years ago working as an investment analyst at Credit Suisse, and he would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
I would tell him to be less fearful and more optimistic about all of the opportunities in the world. And I would tell him that you can imagine a world and you can attract people to this world you've created, to this mission, this construct you've created, in ways that you can't imagine. Being, you know, in a big bank, at an analyst where there's lots of structure, you know, they already have a culture in place, there's very specific, you know, pay criteria and grading, and, you know, your reviews become everything to you. I would say none of those are determinative of your structure, and I would have told him to find other people who are not in the space that gave him a broader perspective on life and helped him realize that his imagination can create things out of nothing, the way Elon has done and many other great entrepreneurs have done. And I will say that even people who are not natural entrepreneurs can learn that skill. I know people will disagree with me on this, and that's a controversial take. But I do think having a little piece of that imagination can create things in the real world, and that has real power, and that positive power can generate real outcomes, I think it's helpful for people to know.
Love it. Imagination can create things out of nothing. Love that. Bharat, thank you very much for taking the time.
It's been great. Thank you for having me on.